Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org.
Staying Put.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Here's an interesting side effect of the current housing market. The number of people willing to change cities for a new job fell to a record low last quarter. Challenger Gray and Christmas says people didn't want to move because they didn't want to sell their homes for a big loss. Even so, Challenger says job seekers who stayed local were able to get work quickly. Employers, on the other hand, griped about the difficulty of finding skilled labor. We also learned this morning that about 1% of U.S. households were in some stage of foreclosure last year. Foreclosures increased 80% over 2006. Florida had one of the highest rates. It also has high property taxes. So that's the Florida state of mind with the Republican primary today. Marketplace's John Dimsdale is in Florida talking to voters.
Floridian Bob Keeler feels like he's taken a direct hit from the falling economy.
I live in Punta Gorda, Florida, and according to the Wall Street Journal, we're the worst place in the country as far as declining values. We're number one in the nation, so I guess being number one sometimes isn't the best thing in the world.
At an AARP rally in Fort Lauderdale yesterday, another voter, who would only identify himself as Joe, said home values are important for senior citizens.
It takes and puts additional pressure on the finances of people that either want to move out of the area because of the cost of living here, or because of the taxes, or because of the property insurance.
But voters say housing issues get short shrift from candidates, with the exception of Rudy Giuliani. He's the only Republican to endorse a taxpayer-financed national catastrophe fund to help ease the pinch of hurricane insurance premiums in Florida. Whether that translates into much-needed votes for the former New York City mayor remains to be seen. In Fort Lauderdale, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The Fed meets today in Washington, but makes a decision on interest rates tomorrow. So far, the Dow is up 27 points in early trading to 12,411. The NASDAQ has dropped 1 point. The S&P 500 is up 3. In Tokyo today, stocks added 3%. European shares are about 1% higher so far. How do you take Wall Street out of the Wall Street Journal? This isn't a riddle. According to the New York Times, Rupert Murdoch is planning to move the Journal to Midtown Manhattan, maybe even to the same building as the Fox News Channel. Jeremy Hobson has more.
The Journal has called the Wall Street area of Lower Manhattan home for 119 years. But moving doesn't seem to bother many reporters, who would have an easier commute and maybe better lunch options in Midtown. And it doesn't bother media critic Dan Kennedy, who writes the Media Nation blog.
I don't think anybody has said that the New Yorker suffered by being moved into the Condé Nast building.
On the other hand, says Kennedy, Murdoch's reported plans to add a sports page and a Lifestyles of the Rich supplement are troubling.
The goal that Murdoch has seems to be to turn the Journal into more and more of a general interest newspaper that will compete head-to-head with the New York Times. And he may very well end up harming its coverage of business and finance.
That fear was raised when Murdoch acquired the paper's parent company, Dow Jones, for $5 billion last year. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
This is the Morning Report for Tuesday, January 29th on Marketplace.org. Americans plan to spend $10 billion getting ready for the Super Bowl this Sunday. New TV sets and furniture, and of course, 50 million pounds of avocados. You gotta have guacamole, right? Last year at this time, the U.S. lifted a ban on Mexican avocados. We decided to check in on how U.S. growers have fared since then. Dan Gretz reports from our America's desk at WLRN.
Trade is usually thought of as a zero-sum game. If Mexico ships more products into the U.S., then U.S. producers are hurt. Avocados, it turns out, are different. A year ago, the USDA lifted a 93-year-old ban on avocado exports to avocado-producing states. The result?
The outlook is still very good for all the parties involved.
That's Guy Whitney with the California Avocado Commission. He says Mexican growers are seen as partners, not competitors. That's because Mexico's growing season ends when the U.S. season begins, stoking demand year-round.
Because of the seasonality of the fruit, right now there is adequate space for everybody in the U.S. domestic market. Not to say that that's going to be the case forever.
Whitney says Peru has an avocado growing season that mirrors the U.S., and the South American nation is lobbying hard to enter the U.S. market. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Now for part two of our series, Plan B, investing in ideas to deal with global warming. We head to the Netherlands, one of the most densely populated countries on the planet, and it's among the most threatened by climate change. Nearly two-thirds of the people live below sea level. The ground is kept dry using pumps and dikes, but water levels are rising, and some Dutch folks are rising above the water. Marketplace's Rico Galliano has this story from the town of Maasbommel.
Property manager Adrie van Ooyen runs a lakeside water recreation area in Maasbommel. It's great for boating and swimming, but it's becoming better known for 46 pastel-colored vacation houses built by the Dutch company Dura Vermeer.
You want to tell me where we're going?
Okay, we're going to the new houses, the houses who can swim.
They're going to swim?
Yes, yes.
In other words, they float. If the Maas River floods, the lakeside houses can rise as high as 18 feet, sliding up and down around iron pillars driven deep into the ground.
It's an experiment to build in an area where the water can go very high, so they are floating. Only some cables for the electricity, the gas, is connected to the land.
An amphibious house is nothing like the tiny houseboats you find on Amsterdam's canals. For one thing, it's got 1,300 square feet of space. This one, owned by a woman named Astrid, has a manicured lawn, a little driveway.
Am I to understand the dog does not like me?
All the comforts of suburbia. And inside, we're talking three bedrooms, living room, kitchen, bathroom.
If I go downstairs, it's not going to look like a boat.
It is a house, not a boat.
It's sure priced like a house. Over 300,000 bucks to build, 440,000 to buy. But the floating homes of the future could be cheaper.
At a certain time, it will be prefabricated more and more, and then the prices go down.
That's Wim Verkerk of Advin, the company that helped Dura Vermeer engineer its amphibious housing. He says the technology could bring in a tidal wave of cash. With space at a premium in the tiny Netherlands, Dutch developers would love to build on water. The rest of the world is interested, too.
There are several places where big cities are built next to the rivers, and most of the times you have some fluctuation of the water level almost everywhere.
Dura Vermeer just landed a contract to build a floating house on the Thames River in London. Taiwan commissioned a study for typhoon-proof restaurants and galleries in a harbor. And other Dutch architects are getting their feet wet. A firm called Water Studio is designing a floating mosque for Dubai. But Verkerk worries the general public still considers all this a novelty, not the future.
A lot of people do a bit of laughing about it. It's the same reaction like Noah building the arch.
The arch?
Yes, the arch. Everybody laughed and said, Noah, you're foolish. And that's the same as what's happening now. People laugh until something happens, and then they realize, well.
In the Netherlands, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Our series was produced in conjunction with the Center for Investigative Reporting. A study out today suggests what a candidate looks like has a lot to do with their chances of getting elected. Researchers studied the effectiveness of branding and advertising in 112 congressional campaigns. They found that Republicans who had the most success appeared competent and trustworthy, the high school quarterback stereotype. Democrats preferred candidates who seemed intelligent and likable, more of a college professor type. Marketing professor Michael Lewis led this study at Washington University in St. Louis. So, Michael, are we boiling elections down to an appearance contest?
Oh, no, no, no. I mean, you know, we looked at both spending and these appearance variables. And while, you know, what a candidate looks like is important, how much the candidate has to spend to get the message out there is much, much more so important.
So now we're saying that the amount of money that they spend plus the appearance, those two are the most important things.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a way, you know, we found this, sort of viewed this as a positive. Money, and I know a lot of people would think that the money driving political results is kind of unfortunate, but our, you know, our take on it was when there was more money involved and the messages were actually getting out, those effects dwarfed the appearance effects.
Well, what about how the money is spent or who is spending the money?
Well, we actually did find a couple of interesting results there as well. Challengers actually ended up getting a better rate of return in terms of vote share for the amount of money we spent. And perhaps even more strikingly, we found that challengers tended to do better when they engaged in negative advertising, where incumbents actually tended to hurt themselves when they went negative. To sort of put this in marketing terms, if we think about incumbents as established brands that voters or consumers are very aware of, I think there should be a lot of hesitation about going negative.
Mm-hmm. Have you made any immediate connections between what you found and the candidates that are out there on the trail right now?
I mean, we haven't directly assessed the appearance advantages of the presidential contenders at this point. We've had a lot of conversation about it, of course. Let's say this. I mean, on the Republican side, there's one candidate who quickly comes to mind, and that's Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he looks like the prototypical Republican candidate. On the Democratic side, you know, we've had a lot of discussion about, you know, some of these other traits like likability. And in particular, when we, you know, see how Hillary Clinton is performing on the campaign trail versus Obama, you know, there is something of a likability gap. And so the appearance variables are not the whole story, but they do seem to tell a story that's consistent with what we're seeing play out.
Michael Lewis is a marketing professor at the Business School at Washington University in St. Louis. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In Los Angeles, I'm Scott J. Gal. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.